some more attention in Duval County, but the funding is harder to come by. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Jessica Palumbo, in for Melissa Ross. We're always live here at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. You can also catch up on all of our shows at wjctnews.org or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, Florida is among the 6 worst states for low access to mental health care combined with a high rate of incarceration. But Jacksonville is making some progress toward fixing that. Our question to callers, how could mental health care be better in Northeast Florida? Join our conversation now at 549-2937. Then a new support network for lung cancer patients in Jacksonville. Plus, part of the cast of Dreamgirls is here with a preview. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first, mental health advocates in Northeast Florida are celebrating some victories when it comes to giving people more access to services. But funding is still lacking. Mental Health America of Northeast Florida President and CEO Denise Marzullo is here to talk about what's being done. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, we just heard that statistic about Florida. That comes from the latest Mental Health America report that we're one of the worst states when it comes to low access to mental health care. And we also have a relatively high rate of people in prison or jail. How are those two connected, Denise?
So they're really interconnected. Unfortunately, Florida is 49th in per capita mental health funding, mm-hmm. which means that per person mental health funding that's allocated in our state budget, we're the second to lowest state. And so with that comes a lack of services to really treat people who live with mostly a severe mental illness. We know that roughly 23% of adults in Florida do not have health insurance. So what often happens is people who have a severe mental illness, they're hospitalized oftentimes. They're given 30 days worth of medication and there's not much follow-up. So they either end up rehospitalized or unfortunately, oftentimes in our criminal justice system, not for your violent crimes. They're oftentimes for misdemeanor, nonviolent type crimes. Mm. But the recidivism rate for people who live with a mental illness in and out of our jail system is extremely high in our state because we lack the services that people need.
Now, just focusing here in Northeast Florida, and before we get to some of the proposed solutions and some of the good things mm-hmm. that are happening, let's talk about the need for mental health care here in Northeast Florida. And is there a shortage? And if so, what are the most critical areas?
There's a significant shortage of especially psychiatrists in the state of Florida and in Northeast Florida. So when you have really low funding, it's hard to attract psychiatrists to this community. So there's a shortage nationally. Mm-hmm. Nationally, there's a need for roughly 13,000 psychiatrists, and we only have about 7,000. So then you can imagine how many come to our state, and we have only a few residency slots here for psychiatric residency programs in Northeast Florida. So we're having a hard time attracting psychiatrists. That's the biggest need in our community as far as for workforce development. And it's especially significant for child psychiatrists. Hmm. We have a severe shortage in this community.
Okay. And when people with a mental illness are released from jail, what options do they have? And do they have enough places to get treatment after that release?
There are not enough places to get treatment. There's not enough levels of care. So what that means is that we don't have any kind of short-term or long-term residential programs. Mm-hmm. So we have outpatient services where people can go and get medication. It's tough to get sometimes, especially if you don't have health insurance. There's long waiting lists. Access to services, as we've talked about, is really difficult. But we don't have any place for people to go to be stabilized. So oftentimes they end up on the streets. And with that increases the homeless rate and lots of other problems. And again, that's when they're oftentimes back in jail.
Now, to our listeners, tell us your thoughts this morning at 549-2937, and we'll get to some of your calls in a moment. But let's now talk, Denise, about some of these solutions. Mm-hmm. And first, it's called a central receiving system. And right. What is that, and where are we in creating that here?
So Northeast Florida was really fortunate. This state allocated a couple of central receiving system grants, and Mental Health Resource Center applied for and received one of those grants. So it's a $3 million a year grant that would come into this community for Mental Health Resource Center to open up, to be able to take patients who don't necessarily meet, they're not suicidal or homicidal, but they're in a crisis. They're in a mental health crisis. Mm-hmm. And so they can go there, see a psychiatrist, see a therapist, see a case manager who can help them get the resources that they might need. Oftentimes, people with a severe mental illness who are at risk of homelessness can't work. And so they may be eligible for Social Security disability income benefits. It's extremely hard to navigate that application process. So they will have benefit specialists located at Mental Health Resource Center who can help people do that. And really it's kind of a one-stop shop, urgent care type model where people who live with a mental illness can come see a therapist and not wait until they're suicidal or homicidal to get the treatment that they need.
And this would be instead of going to an emergency room.
Right. And oftentimes you can't get, unless if you're suicidal or homicidal, going to an emergency room doesn't usually get you the treatment that you need. You need mm-hmm. to see an outpatient psychiatrist. Wait lists are really long. If people don't have insurance, it's even longer. And so this would kind of alleviate a lot of that. So again, when people are released from the jails, they're given 30 days worth of medication. And if they don't have that follow-up appointment, they can kind of start to slide back if they don't have their medication. So they would be able to go to Mental Health Resource Center and get that appointment that they need. It's also going to be a place where when our police officers encounter somebody who is struggling with a mental illness, they don't want to take them to jail. They don't really meet a Baker Act criteria. They could take them to MHRC where they can be triaged and see what services they need. So it's really to divert people from being incarcerated.
And that would be huge because there are so many people with mental illness in our jail.
Exactly.
Now, you're saying this will happen. We mm-hmm. have the $3 million mm-hmm. grant. But in reality, where is that project?
So it is happening. Okay. It's due to open up fully July 1st, 2017. So in about 7 months, they're starting the process and opening up some of the services in January. There is a cash match that has to happen. And so we're looking to our city leaders and other foundations to help with that. So there's a $1.5 million match that the community needs to come up with, and we're working on that. But it is going to happen, and it'll be in full operation as of July 1.
Okay, that is the central receiving facility. And is it a physical one-stop place?
We're calling it a central receiving system.
System, okay.
So it is, the MHRC actually has two sites, one on Beach Boulevard and one off of 20th Street. Mm-hmm. So they would go to the one off of 20th Street to get the outpatient services. The police could take them there to be triaged. And at that point, if they do meet a Baker Act criteria and need to be inpatient hospitalization, then they will transport them to the Beach Boulevard location. But it is that 20th Street location.
Okay. And I know Miami-Dade County mm-hmm. has a similar mm-hmm. situation that is sort of a model. How mm-hmm. would Duval's compare to that one?
So Miami took about 15 years to get theirs up and running. It is amazing the outcomes and the impact that Miami has been able to do, led by the Honorable Judge Steve Lifeman. They passed a 1 cent sales tax. That is critical. Mm-hmm. They needed funding to support the services. It is paid off to the taxpayers tenfold. With that 1 cent sales tax going to mental health and homeless services, they were able to close down an entire jail.
Wow.
A jail that housed over 6,000 inmates. They were able to shut it down. So imagine the amount of money that was put back into the community because of that. And it was because they had a sophisticated mental health court system. They had peer specialists that worked with people who are severely mentally ill interacting with the criminal justice system. They had the benefit specialist. They had CIT training that was really robust, very similar to ours. And so they saved the taxpayers a lot of money by doing that 1 cent sales tax at first.
Well, we have lots of calls waiting on. Right now, we go to Carla. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. So I've been hearing from you a lot of great solutions, but those are after the fact. I think there is a lot of prevention that could be done, especially in the education system. Last year, I worked in a school, Towns Elementary, and I can tell you a lot of the children have a lot of needs. There's only workers in the school. There are no counselors, and a lot of these children have, some of them have disabilities that have gone without or a bad kid, and that kid grows up, drops out of school because he didn't get the help he needed, and becomes sometimes mentally ill because it can be very depressing to not fit in, among other things. And they end up in the system, they end up in jail, and it just perpetuates the cycle. I think if we invested more in education, especially in these mental health resources, we could make a huge difference from the beginning, just avoiding the problem altogether.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Carla. That was Carla in Yulee. And so, as
can
you
I respond to
yes.
that? Yeah. So thank you, Carla. You brought up one of our solutions. So there is an evidence-based national model called Mental Health First Aid. Mm-hmm. And it is very similar to regular first aid, only it's focused on identifying the signs and symptoms of a mental illness. There's youth mental health first aid, and this community is very, very, very fortunate. Our school system got a federal grant, Project Aware, to do mental health first aid in the schools, and that is being rolled out over a 5-year period. I think they're in year 2, and they are training the school personnel on mental health first aid. Mental Health America also got a federal grant, and we are training churches, youth organizations, coaches, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, on identifying some of those early signs and symptoms in our youth. And we also are very, very fortunate because a hospital network, Baptist Health, Brooks Rehab, Mayo Clinic, St. Vincent's Healthcare, and UF Health joined forces with the goal of training 10,000 people in adult mental health first aid. And so they're working with corporations and people to take the course, be trained so that we have that education on what mental illness looks like. And not only that, it provides resources for people to refer people, to get more information, to identify what is going on with somebody. So this community is really fortunate that we are looking at that whole continuum, especially focusing on prevention.
And as it relates to kids, though, you mentioned that there is still that shortage mm-hmm. of counselors specifically mm-hmm. for those kids right. if they are identified.
We do have an amazing full-service schools model here where there are therapists, behaviorists, case managers in the school. It's a huge partnership between United Way of Northeast Florida, the Jacksonville Children's Commission, and local mental health providers that embed therapists into the schools so that parents don't have to worry about taking off work, the kid missing a lot of school, transportation. Mm-hmm. The therapists go to the schools to work with the kids, and it's a huge model. It's not in all schools, and ideally that's where we want to get to. It's going to take more funding, but it is a tremendously effective program.
Okay, now going to Nicole in Mandarin. Good morning, Nicole. You're on the air.
Good morning. So I just thought it was really important for callers to know that this is an issue of access that doesn't just impact, a homeless population or a transient population or a population without insurance. My daughter was hospitalized in inpatient and then partial inpatient care earlier this year. And when she was released, her release was really a nervous time for us as a family because we had serious problems locating adolescent psychiatric care for her on an outpatient basis. So I just thought it was really relevant for callers to know this is an issue that impacts everyone, and you never know when it might impact you and your family.
Absolutely. Thank you for that, Nicole. Denise, as you mentioned, with peer identification, mm-hmm. these issues can be anywhere.
Absolutely. So Nicole is certainly not alone. She's absolutely right. It doesn't just affect a certain segment of our population. It affects everybody. I met with a family yesterday who, father in the military, mother a teacher for decades, and their son is an adult, and he is struggling with a severe mental illness, and they have spent retirement trying to provide care for him. They're struggling with trying to get him the level of services that he needs because it's not available, not only in the public sector, but in the private sector as well. So Nicole's absolutely right. We don't have the services. And oftentimes, if they are available, they're extremely expensive. I know people who have spent anywhere from $500 to $1,000 a day to provide residential care for an adult with a severe mental illness.
Now we go to an email. Tony emails the show and says, a few months ago, Wolfson Children's Behavioral Health Center opened for a place just for kids. Mm-hmm. Large donations from the Weavers, mm-hmm. Hills, and Florida Blue and Baptist Foundations helped make that a reality.
Right, right. That was a really important Our philanthropy community, again, I say Northeast Florida is very fortunate. We've got a lot of struggles, but our philanthropic community, the hospital partnerships, like you said, Wolfson Baptist Health. I'll mention also the Jacksonville System of Care Initiative. That's work that's been going on for just finished up 6 years, mm-hmm. where we have been really identifying what are the strengths in our system that we can improve, what are some model practices we can bring. They've just brought in a child psychiatrist, which is a huge, huge, I just talked about the shortage. They were able to recruit somebody to work with providers in this community. So Baptist Health, the Weavers, I can't say enough about. The Women's Giving Alliance has mm-hmm. stepped in. So this community has been really blessed to have the philanthropic and the support of community collaborations.
Now, let's talk about the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office mm-hmm. and what's being done there mm-hmm. to make officers aware of mm-hmm. mental illness.
So Sheriff Mike Williams picked up right where Sheriff Rutherford had left off. Sheriff Rutherford was a huge champion for mental illness and recognized his role, as does Sheriff Williams, as the CEO of the largest mental health treatment provider in Jacksonville because he oversees Duval County Jail. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that is the largest mental health treatment provider in this community. And so Sheriff Williams is being involved, is working really hard to attend a lot of our community collaborative meetings. There's a criminal justice behavioral health collaborative that's working with the state attorney's office, the public defender's office, the court system, our judicial, our judges, mental health providers. And he's been at meetings learning what he can do and how he can help to kind of divert and treat people instead of them going to jail. He's also looking at the mental health first aid training. All JSO officers already get the 40-hour CIT training, which is rare in this mm-hmm. state. And our sheriff's office has been committed to that for decades. And so Sheriff Williams is really playing a significant role in trying to. Jail is not meant to be a treatment provider. They're never going to be. It's not supposed to be. And so I think if we continue to work with the mayor's office, the sheriff's office, the mental health community, the philanthropic community, the hospital community, we can really help to fill some of these gaps. But again, we've got to look at our state and we've got to look at our state legislators to increase our mental health budget because we can only fill gaps for so long. We need to take a systemic approach, mm-hmm. and it's going to require some funding.
Now, in just a moment, we'll get to how we fared in the legislature, how mm-hmm. mental health funding fared in the legislature. We have Lori on hold. Now, Lori on the West Side, you are on the air.
Yes. I'm actually reaching for the definition of terms when it comes to severe mental illness because, for example, in some societies, being gay is a severe mental illness. If in some societies the definition is not there, and I am just wondering how it's being used here. That's
okay.
My question, and you can answer it off the air.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks. Denise?
So when I talk about severe mental illness, I'm certainly not talking about gay or anything like that. Where I'm talking about diagnosis in what's called the DSM manual, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which is what therapists and psychiatrists and psychiatric professionals use. So we're talking about major depression, bipolar disorder, your psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia, anxiety, PTSD. There's a whole continuum and range of diagnoses. But we're talking about illnesses that are diseases in the brain that are in the statistical manual that we use to diagnose somebody.
And that would be debilitating to somebody who has those.
Right. So it's on a continuum. It's not either you have it or you don't.
Yeah.
There are certain days where you might feel a little bit more sad and depressed on one day than another. And so it's definitely on a continuum. There it goes from mild to severe. It can go from acute to chronic. So some of your psychotic disorders like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, which is a mood disorder, they're more chronic. You're likely to have them. They're all treatable. They're not curable, but they are treatable with therapy, support, sometimes medication. And that's really important for people to understand that they are treatable, and you can have acute and get treatment and be better and be mentally healthy for a really long time, maybe the rest of your life. But some people do have chronic mental illnesses.
All right. More callers on the line. Robert in St. Augustine. Good morning, Robert. You are on the air.
Good morning. I'd just like to make a couple of points and ask a simple question. With the United States being, per capita, using approximately 20 times more anti-anxieties and antidepressant drugs than any other country in the world, and what I would say is an association with similar kinds of statistics of people being jailed, I don't understand why the United States can't look at our society as being something that is full of stress, high stress, to be able to function and compete, and why are we dealing with this as a national health crisis. Because I believe this is a national health crisis that is being in large part produced by just the nature of our market economy. I'll take my answer or response off the air.
Okay, thank you, Robert, for that. You're nodding your head, Denise.
He's right. I mean, I would say it's a national health crisis. It's my profession, so I genuinely believe that. I've looked at the research as well, Robert, and you're absolutely correct. There's a lot of pressures on our society. There's a lot of stress. There's a lot going on, and so I think we are in a very critical state with mental illness, not only locally, but nationally as well. I think that it takes education. So programs such as this and other educational forums where people can really understand what's going on. I don't think that the value has been placed on mental illness as much as it needs to be. There is a stigma. So oftentimes people don't talk about it in the way that they used to not talk about breast cancer decades ago. And so there's a lot of work in trying to change that. And I think it starts with education. I think it starts with the mental health first aid and understanding the myths versus the realities of mental illness. And I think it's going to take some people kind of stepping out and talking about their mental illness, their family members' mental illness without that judgment. And I think when we can overcome that stigma and our elected officials will start talking about it more, it'll become more a priority and we'll look to treating it effectively.
Now, speaking of those elected officials, briefly, let's look back at the last legislative session. And were there some bright spots there for you?
We had some real success in 2016. We had some elected officials statewide, even locally, that really helped push the momentum forward. So we got a funding increase for the first time since the early 90s. Mm. Since the early 90s, our state funding finally improved by $53 million. It didn't take us out of 49th. We need a lot more money. The funding went to specific programs and services, which are important. We also passed what was called Senate Bill 12, which really kind of did an upheaval on some of the barriers for people getting treatment. opened up this no wrong door kind of policy. You can get services regardless of where you are and what insurance you have. We passed, thanks to Representative Charles McBurney from Northeast Florida, we passed the Codifying Mental Health Courts Bill, which was a step in the right direction. We didn't get the funding to go with it, which was a critical part of it, but we did step in the right direction thanks to his leadership. We also passed a nurse practitioner, physician's assistants prescribing privileges bill. And so that might be confusing, but Florida was the only state where advanced registered nurse practitioners and physician's assistants could not prescribe controlled medications, even though they were fully trained to. Mm. And so that passed this year as well. So we had some significant successes, but we're in no way there yet. We have a lot more work to do. So we celebrated in July, and now it's time to kind of move forward and make 2017 just as good and even better.
And the Florida legislature meeting for the first time this week in Tallahassee, I'm sure you're looking forward to talking to all of them going into 2017.
Yes.
My guest this morning is Denise Marzullo, President and CEO of Mental Health America of Northeast Florida. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, some do's and don'ts of holiday shopping. We'll be right back after this.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Independent music transcends genre, form, and age. At Indie Endeavor, we endeavor to shine a light in the little explored dark corners of your musical imagination. Everything from new to old, foreign to domestic, electronic to acoustic, we play it all. Indie Endeavor, Tuesdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. I am Jessica Palumbo in for Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. And it's almost time to start that holiday shopping if you haven't started it already. And sometimes we get caught up in the holidays and we overspend and find ourselves with a big credit card bill come January. So here to talk about the do's and don'ts of holiday shopping, we're now joined by Legacy Trust Director Marty Flack. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Relationship Manager with Legacy Trust, Holly Terrell. Good morning.
Good morning, Jessica.
Now, Holly, all right, so you mean we don't just spend? That's not a good idea?
It can be a good idea, but we want to have a plan first. We want to set expectations for those that we're going to be giving to. And, of course, we want to remain joyful and have fun this holiday season.
How can we remain joyful and responsible at the same time?
That's a great question. I think having some creative, different ways of spending can allow you to remain less debt-free as you go into January. And you can create those expectations with your family members by maybe only doing 3 gifts with each other.
Okay.
Enjoying time together, creating some holiday experiences, like maybe going ice skating as a family, instead of just giving gifts that are going to be unwrapped and then maybe forgotten about.
Sure. Are there any other creative ways that you've thought of?
Well, Elfstar.com is kind of fun. Okay. You can actually do a secret Santa with your family members, and they don't even have to be in the same household. So if you have international family members or families that live outside of the state, you can do this through an application or on a web site, which is a lot of fun.
And that's called Elfstar?
Elfstar, ELFSTER.com.
Okay, I haven't heard of that one. So that's the idea there is that you're only buying one gift instead of a whole bunch of gifts for a whole bunch of people.
Exactly.
Okay.
Because 25 gifts for all those cousins and aunts and uncles that you may not know what to actually get for them
right.
can be a little overwhelming.
Sure.
Of course, giving of yourself is a great gift that you can give. So maybe you have a special talent like chocolate chip cookies or a homemade recipe that you can share with a next door neighbor that you might want to give something to.
Sure. All right. Marty, now switching gears from being responsible to let's look in your crystal ball for a moment. Okay, so now that we've had the presidential election, we're going into 2017. What do you predict for the stock market? How is that going?
So we're already experiencing a rally coming off the election. And part of the reason is, of course, that the markets were expecting the Hillary Clinton to win and that the Democrats would still control at least one of the houses. Instead, what we have is Trump as president and the Republicans now control the House or Congress. So the market's looking at this and looking at a very proactive policy by Trump, although the policies haven't been laid out. It's more of the anticipation. And the anticipation is for tax cuts for both individual and corporates. So that would be a good fiscal stimulus. In addition to that, Trump has already said that he believes in strong infrastructure spending. So the markets are already looking into the future, the equity markets, and discounting that and saying that's going to be a good stimulus for the economy going forward. So the markets have been rallying. In fact, they set a record high as of yesterday.
Okay. So good news for your retirement accounts going into 2017.
That's the anticipation. So anything can happen in between as the policies get rolled out, but the market's reading between the lines of what Trump may do. And so as a result, the markets like the additional increased spending, although it will drive the deficit up. And that bodes well for the equity markets going into 2017.
All right. Now, as we approach the end of the year, there are a couple things that many of us are thinking about as far as personal finances and keeping everything in check. Holly, what should people be thinking about?
Great. We definitely want to max out your individual retirement accounts, your IRAs, your Roth IRAs, and that individual savings account as well. You want to make sure you have an emergency savings on hand to pay for those unexpected expenses that are going to happen.
Mm. Okay. And as far as charitable giving, what do you recommend for people at the end of the year?
So as people over the age of 70 and a half have to take their RMDs, required minimum distributions, from their IRA accounts, they would want to potentially look at making charitable gifts through their RMDs as a tax write-off and having those come to them tax-free. And then they would also want to just make sure that they have other savings set aside.
Okay. So saving, make sure that you have enough of a cushion there going into the end of the year, and make sure that you're making those contributions to your own retirement account and to any charities that you're looking to support.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That is Marty Flack and Holly Terrell with Legacy Trust with some tips for your personal finances here at the end of the year. Thank you very much for being here this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we will be right back after this break.
WJCT and Vistar Credit Union are honoring the memory of Fred Rogers with Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used sweaters, jackets, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped at WJCT and all Vistar Credit Union locations and Two Men in a Truck at 8849 Arlington Expressway. For more information, log on to WJCT.org. Contributions will be donated to selected nonprofit facilities within the First Coast area.
Let all of us at WJCT take a moment to express our thanks and gratitude to you. Your support of WJCT this year has helped bring the best in news, drama, performance, ideas, and culture to all across the First Coast. And thanks to you, We intend to accomplish even more in the year to come. Our best wishes to you for a wonderful Thanksgiving and holiday season.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I am Jessica Palumbo. November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. The Lung Cancer Support Network is a cancer support program open to all Duval County residents living with a lung cancer diagnosis. Lung cancer is the second most commonly diagnosed cancer. In fact, it accounts for 14% of new cancer cases annually in the U.S. North Florida just has a handful of lung cancer support resources, though. And meanwhile, since the 1990s, lung cancer mortality rates have decreased, so more survivors are in need of post-treatment support. And that's where the Lung Cancer Support Network comes in. We're now joined by Dr. Paul Clark, one of the Living with Lung Cancer Network's founders and an assistant professor of social work at the University of North Florida. Good morning,
Good morning, Dr. Clark.
Thank you for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
So is the Lung Cancer Support Network relatively new?
Yes, the group got started about 3 months ago.
Oh, wow.
And we've had a wonderful turnout. We always have room for new members, of course. And I think one thing I wanted to add to what you were saying about the resources in North Florida is that people really are surviving with lung cancer diagnoses, and not only are they needing support at the time of diagnosis, but certainly during and after treatment as well. So we like to have people join our group wherever they are in this particular experience, and we're glad to have them come.
Now, can you tell us about any of the patients who have come through the program in this in these 3 months and what it's done for them?
Well, at this point, I think probably it's important for people who are sharing this diagnosis to have an opportunity to be with each other and to sort of not only share information about their experiences, but to learn new things about the diagnosis. One of the things that I think is probably more common with lung cancer than perhaps other cancers is that there's a real stigma attached to it. You know, oftentimes people assume that if someone has lung cancer, somehow they're at fault for that, like they smoked or something along those lines.
Right.
And it's important to remember that while smoking can be a factor in getting a lung cancer diagnosis, there are plenty of people that never smoked that get this diagnosis. And so oftentimes people really have what they call kind of a stacked stigma kind of experience, where not only is the cancer diagnosis itself a little bit stigmatizing, but now if there's lung cancer on top of it and the sort of the association with smoking, there's almost a tendency to blame.
Yeah.
And so the group is really a place where people can come and there's no blame there. And people get you and can sort of understand your experience and sort of, you know, address the kinds of things that come up as a part of treatment and diagnosis.
So how does the support network work? Where do people come and how often do they meet?
Okay, well, our groups are meeting on the second Monday evening of each month at the Ackerman Cancer Center, which is located right off of 295 and San Jose Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to coming, it's good to call and chat with my co-facilitator, a clinical social worker, Eden Mock. And they can just call up and, you know, let us know that they're coming so we have an idea of how many people to expect. But certainly people are welcome to join us. The group does spend time sharing and talking about their experiences, to be sure, but we also will oftentimes begin the group with some kind of an educational presentation. So this past month, we had the science behind lung cancer growth, types, and treatment presented by one of the physicians at Ackerman. And next month, in December, we'll have a nutritionist come and talk a little bit about nutrition issues during treatment and afterward and that kind of thing. So we'll start off with a little bit of sort of information and education, and then people have an opportunity to sort of share their own experiences with their lung cancer.
Okay. So you're one of the founders of the Lung Cancer Support Network.
I guess, yeah. I think it was really more of a collaboration. After coming back to this area from living in the D.C. area for a decade or so, one of the things that I realized was that, you know, despite the fact that cancer is, or lung cancer is the number two diagnosis in the country, and in Florida it's the number three most common cancer diagnosis, there aren't a lot of resources for people that are living with a diagnosis here. started chatting with one of my oncology social work colleagues, Jennifer Maggiore, who is works at Ackerman Cancer Center. And it was through conversations with her and the willingness of Dr. Ackerman to really provide space for the group that we're able to meet. So it really took a lot of different people to make this happen.
And is this geared toward families of patients as well?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we encourage people to do is not only come if they have a diagnosis, but, you know, anybody in their life that's been affected by their diagnosis. So it could be other family members, their spouse, their caregiver, or whoever. They're certainly welcome to come.
All right. Anything else you want people to know about the network?
Well, there's no charge at all for coming. The only thing that we ask is that you give us a little bit of notice before you come so we know who to expect and that kind of thing. We hope that if you come once, you'll come more than once, but you certainly can come once and try it and not, you don't have to come back. There's no commitment. In other words, we hope that you're coming because you want to, and certainly you can come once or twice or every other month, whatever. It's perfectly okay.
Now, is lung cancer getting to be more of a survivable diagnosis?
Absolutely. You know, and I think that's the other thing that's helpful, coming to a support group. You can, hear about other people's experiences and, you know, maybe ask about other kinds of, you know, treatments. You know, we have more immunotherapies and targeted therapies and, of course, proton therapy, all of these things we didn't really have 10 years ago when I started doing lung cancer support groups. And so it's been very exciting to see more options available to people. And I think, you know, maybe over time when some of the stigma wears away from this diagnosis, there'll be more funding for research and we'll have more exciting kinds of treatment options available.
Okay, so you've been working with support groups for a decade.
Yeah.
Is it getting to be less depressing in those support groups?
You know what? It's actually never been depressing. And in fact, I remember where I was working before here, we would have graduate students sometimes come through and they will sit down on different kinds of diagnosis-specific support groups. And it wasn't uncommon at all for our grad student to come to me after they'd sat in with our group and say, you know, of all the groups I've been with, the lung cancer people have the best sense of humor, you know? And I thought, well, I think you're probably right about that. So it's never been kind of a depressing experience for me at least, so. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Paul Clark, thank you so much for being here. He's with the Living with Lung Cancer Network here in Jacksonville, a new support group for people with diagnosis of lung cancer. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Goodwill of North Florida. Donate, shop, jobs. Good things for North Florida with Goodwill. Proud supporters of WJCT's First Coast Connect. GoodwillJax.org for more info.
Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. Tune in every Monday night at 11 and discover new music. As one of the most enduring musical genres, blues can give you a shoulder to cry on, a heart to hang on to, and is here to let you know
everything gonna be alright.
Blues Horizon, every Monday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I say, baby, everything gonna be alright. I say.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part 2. Sponsored in part by AARP Real Possibilities.
And finally this hour, it was a Tony Award-winning musical that became an Oscar-winning movie. Dreamgirls tells the story of three young sisters who become superstars. It's being performed this month by the Stage Aurora Theater Company at the Ritz Theater and Museum. And if you haven't seen it yet, you have two more chances this Saturday and Sunday. Joining us now are cast members and Aurora, Stage Aurora founder, Daryl Reuben Hall. Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
And cast members Patrick Johnson and Ebony Murray. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thank you all for being here. Daryl Reuben Hall, let's start with you. You are the founder of Stage Aurora,
yes.
And WJCT News has been following your journey over the past couple of years.
Yes.
So fill us in on how you came to the Ritz from what was the north side of Jacksonville before.
Yes, yes, from Gateway.
Yes.
I was actually in the Wiz at the Alhambra. We were actually rehearsing, and I started getting all these voicemails, all these phone calls about, Daryl, we want to talk to you about bringing Stage Aurora to the Ritz Theater Company. So they reached out to me. We met several times, and then we incorporated the SMG Corporation, joined the meetings, and we started laying all the details out. And the one thing they said was that my brand is proven, that Stage Aurora is known, you know, for great theater, and I've been very consistent at it. And so they thought it would be a great fit, because, you know, we had to leave Jacksonville. The new owners decided to close the mall, that section anyway. And we were looking for a home.
Right.
Because you had already interviewed me, you know, several times. And then one thing led to another, and here we are, and Dreamgirls is the first production in that collaboration. So, yeah.
All right. So what is it like, Ebony, to perform at the Ritz?
Well, it's breathtaking, to be honest. This is my first lead role in about 10 years.
Oh, and what is your character?
Oh, speaking of my character, Dena Jones is who I play, who was also played by Beyonce in the movie and Diana Ross. Mm-hmm. Extremely excited because she's beautiful, and she's always been beautiful.
Dena's always been beautiful.
But you get a chance to see another side of who I am as a person. I had to take myself out of the role and begin to play someone that I know I probably will never be.
Okay. And Patrick, what is your character?
Well, I play Cece White, Claridge Conrad White. He is the writer for The Dreams, and he's also Effie White's brother, baby brother. Let's see. He is a very passive young man. He starts off passive and then becomes a little bit more aggressive as he grows older. You can see the evolution of CC, not just as a songwriter, but also as a young man. And it kind of helped me to back up and see that. And that's okay. Well, I see my elevation and see my evolution. So I really had to take back, as she did as well, and say, okay, that's not me. So I got to be this other person.
Now, I understand we're going to get a pre-Thanksgiving treat here, and we're going to hear a little bit of Dreamgirls. So now, Ebony, can you tell us, what is the song that we're about to hear?
The song we're about to hear is called We Are a Family.
Yes.
And it speaks volume to Effie White. Effie is known to be a leader. She's always been a leader, and everyone knows that in the play. But we want her to realize that sometimes it doesn't always take the leader to take the full role. Allow everyone to work together and become a family, like a giant tree.
Yes.
And allow us to work together. She had a hard time working together. It's like she always wanted it. She felt like the world was against her and that she was against the world. So,
okay.
Let's see what we can do.
Are we ready?
Yeah, we're
ready. Warmed up?
Me.
Yeah,
we're
ready.
Okay. Cast members of Dreamgirls, Patrick Johnson and Ebony Murray here in studio with a little preview of Dreamgirls. Hit it.
All right, here we go.
We are a family, like a giant tree, branching out towards the sky. We are a family, we are so much more than just you and I. We are a family, like a giant tree, growing stronger, growing wiser. We are growing. Free, we need you. We are a family.
Well, well, well.
So good. good. I got the front row seat right here.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do.
Yes.
Thank you. And Daryl Reuben Hall, tell us, for people who have not seen Dreamgirls, how can they get themselves to go see it now?
You can go get tickets on Ticketmaster.com, but it's probably best to go to the Ritz box office so that you can save. It's the holiday season, and they're cheaper if you get them in advance at the Ritz Theater Museum box office.
Okay, and show times?
Saturday, November 26th at 8 p.m., and then Sunday, November 27th at 3 p.m.
Okay, so if you have family in town for Thanksgiving, take them out to the theater.
Yes.
Come see Dreamgirls at the Ritz in downtown Jacksonville by the Stage Aurora Theater Company. Mm-hmm. That was Daryl Reuben Hall, Patrick Johnson, and Ebony Murray. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Jesse. Wow.
Thank you. And that is our show today. Thank you to all of our guests and our callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart, and Ryan Bank is running the board. The show's theme song is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes. Coming up next on the Diane Rehm Show, some good news. A recent study suggests between 2000 and 2012, dementia rates for older Americans fell by 24%. Guests discuss why and ongoing efforts to address what remains a daunting public health crisis. That's coming up next. I'm Jessica Palumbo. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT Jacksonville, your community, your world. We're taking a few days off for the Thanksgiving holiday, but join us tomorrow at 9 for a special broadcast of Swamp Radio. Melissa Ross will be back Monday morning. Have a great Thanksgiving, everyone.
Thank you.
Dreamgirls will make you feel alright. Dreamgirls keep you dreaming your whole life through.
Your dreamgirls can make your dreams come true.
Because dreamgirls always will make you happy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. With your dreamgirls boys will always care. With your dreamgirls, dreamgirls will never leave you. No, no. And all you have to do is dream, baby. We'll be there, yeah. Dream. Dreamgirls will help you to survive. Fantasies alive.
Girls always love you and they'll be true.
Your dreamgirl can only make love to you. I'm not the dream that you had before. I'm the dream that will give you more and more. Your dreamgirls, boys, will make you happy.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.